May 4, 2005, House Water Committee. We are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2915. And with that, we would like to ask Yvonne Valette, John Lilly, to please Mr. Lilly, were you going to introduce Yvonne for us?
I certainly can. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. With us today is Yvonne Valette from the Oregon Office of the Environmental Protection Agency, and Yvonne has a deep experience with working with 404 assumption and 404 issues in the state of Oregon, and I think her testimony could be helpful to your committee and as you deliberate over these issues before you today.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about the crosswalk between the bill that's proposed before this committee right now and some of the efforts that we've been working with on with Division of State Lands on 404 assumption. For clarification, I am the
For the record, if you would give us your name.
Sure. My name is Yvonne Valette, and I'm actually the wetland coordinator for EPA for the state of Oregon. So I work a lot on 404-related and watershed-related matters in the state of Oregon. And I've been working specifically on 404 assumption issues in the state of Oregon since 1997. And what I'd like to explain is a little bit about what 404 assumption is, because it is under the purview of the Environmental Protection Agency. And understand that under current processes, that applicants that propose to do dredge or fill removal projects in Oregon basically must obtain two separate permits, one from the state of Oregon and one from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And while we have a joint permitting process, basically the decision-making process for those permits actually operate on very separate tracks. In the federal realm, we have additional considerations that have to be evaluated under the permitting process, which includes water quality standards, historic preservation, as well as Endangered Species Act coordinations. But we also have to consider the numerous public interests that basically interject into the permitting process. So what we wind up with in a joint permitting process is sometimes two joint processes or two permits, but with very separate conditions and approvals associated with that. So DSL may issue an authorization with a certain set of conditions, and under the federal rules, basically we may also issue authorization but with very different conditions and terms associated with that authorization. And that's just the nature of the separation of federal and state interests. So 404 assumption is basically meant to try to integrate those two processes into a single process under state control. Currently, we have two states, which is Michigan and New Jersey. And Michigan was basically approved in 1984, and New Jersey, which was approved in 1994. So we sort of have this 10-year time frame, which we've sort of missed the window of in Oregon. But basically, it's an integrated program of combining the federal and state standards into a single process. We also have currently both the state of Kentucky and Florida that are actually also actively pursuing 404 assumption, as well as Oregon. The reason why many of our states pursue 404 assumption is basically to provide a better level of service to their constituents. So what they do is hopefully marry the best of the federal regulations with federal standards and marry those into a single permitting process. So that what it provides for many of our developers is at least a time saving in money, and certainty is what the final outcome is, as compared to having two separate authorizations that may have different terms and additions associated with them. What it provides for the state governments, though, is a better use of limited state resources into providing certainty and outcome, but again, combined with some of those state conditions. But also keep in mind, too, that under the 404 regulations, when they were written basically by Congress, they had in mind that the states would actually assume the 404 program, not unlike for many of the other Clean Water Act programs that are administered by, in this case in Oregon, the Department of Environmental Quality. So many of our 402 and stormwater and other programs that are administered by the state, 404 is actually envisioned to be an assumed program or a program administered by the states. What EPA has done is actually provided financial support for states to build their programs towards that assumption. It's sort of what we call the brass ring for 404 assumption. So we have provided actually over $15 million each year to states to try to work towards those, developing those programs towards 404 assumption. We have actually provided a great level of funding to the state of Oregon working towards that goal. And like I said, we actually believe that the state of Oregon has actually worked very, very hard and using their current administrative rules and their current state and fill and removal law is a great impetus. It's sort of like the goal that we strive to achieve for assumption in many of our states. But what this House Bill 2915 would do is basically renege on a deal that we thought we had with the state of Oregon as far as pursuing 404 assumption. Senate Bill 172 was basically the first solid commitment that EPA had from the state of Oregon as far as working progressively to a 404 assumption. It was the first solid piece that we had that says we're serious about this and we're asking for the commitment of resources. EPA has actually committed significant resources towards working with the state of Oregon in pursuing 404 assumption. And so repealing those provisions basically kind of sets us back to what we call a square one situation. So we're a little concerned about that because we have worked really over at least an eight-year tenure to working towards addressing many of the issues for 404 assumption in the state of Oregon. We have heard many of the considerations and concerns expressed by different interest groups about 404 assumption. It seems like the primary concerns have been expressed by the ag interests. I would like to clarify, at least for the record, that the exemptions that are expressed both in the federal exemptions as well as the state exemptions are actually not unlike each other. There are subtle differences that we are trying to work out as far as terminology and implementation. But the reality is that even if the state doesn't cover it, we still cover it in the federal jurisdiction. Through 404 assumption, we actually hope to provide actually a more seamless application about what those exemptions for agriculture and silviculture actually mean, so that there's one set of rules as compared to two separate rules that would apply. But we do also have a caveat in that a state-assumed program cannot have standards that are less or the lowest common denominator under federal rules. So the 50 cubic yard exemption basically would have to go away under a 50 cubic yard exemption. And we know that's of concern to the ag community. But the 50 cubic yard exemption is not an exemption that's identified in federal standards. So what we're trying to do is work with the state of Oregon to try to identify some other ways to allow not necessarily an exemption, but some rules that will be employed basically for agricultural exemption, which means clarification about what agricultural exemptions are and what rules would be employed as far as the extent of those exemptions. But the question about how far is the state in finalizing its 404 application to EPA, what we have worked with the state of Oregon is what we call the full meal deal. It's a little like, you ordered in McDonald's, you ordered the hamburger, but you also want the fries. What we have acknowledged in a full meal deal is that a state program general permit, which provides coverage in Section 10 waterways, is an important component for an assumed program, particularly the extent of Section 10 under the River and Harbors Act waterways that we have in the state. While Congress acknowledged the fact that 404 waters were assumable by states, the Corps of Engineers does not have a mechanism to give or transfer authorization under the River and Harbors Act to states. So by developing a state program general permit, we are allowed to basically do a kind of, it's sort of a mini assumption, because it allows the states to basically administer a permitting program in those waterways for small projects. So it provides, again, a seamless application of their program between state and federal regulations. The other issues that we have been working with, we've been working on integration of many of the other relationships that Division of State Lands has with other agencies, such as Department of Forestry, Department of Ag, as well as Department of Parks, and figuring out, like, what's the nuances. If the state was to assume the program, what does that mean to those relationships? So we've been exploring those issues, and I think we feel as though we have a comfort level of assurance that it would be a seamless program for many of those jurisdictions. Also, while the state of Oregon has worked on a state program general permit, EPA has felt strong enough about the resources that they have dedicated to that we are actually considering funding for a 3-year period implementation of the state program general permit. We have not made a final decision on that, but it is ranking very high as far as consideration for our funding criteria. So the steps that we have left as far as a 404 assumption package, meaning what's next to make this actually happen, we actually have, we've basically been dealing with the low-hanging fruit, we actually have a number of other issues, such as we do need a state attorney general's equivalency review that looks at all the merits of the DSL's programs and statutes to figure out exactly how we have alignment between federal requirements and state requirements. And we also would be developing basically a memorandum of understanding or agreement basically between EPA and the state as to how this program would be implemented. So while we are transferring under a state assumption program authorities from the Corps of Engineers to the state, what you're substituting is basically an agreement with EPA. EPA still administers some oversight. So we still have a number of pieces that need to fall into play as to what is EPA's role in this as far as monitoring the progress of the program, what projects may be subject to federal review, because we do have a great deal of the Endangered Species Act in the state, and we need to figure out a way to deal with those issues. And then we also have, like I said, some of the other considerations such as water quality certification, coastal zone management. So we would need to develop some side agreements with those entities about how an assumed program would actually operate in Oregon. But I have to say that repealing the requirements of Senate Bill 172 basically does set things back because it doesn't provide to EPA the assurance that the state is serious about pursuing 404 assumption. We go back to square one on a lot of these issues that we've been negotiating with some of our partners, and so we would have no assurance that we would be able to find the technical and legal support in reviewing products submitted by the state for 404 assumption. And I understand that 404 assumption is a complicated issue, and what I'm offering here is at least an opportunity to ask questions of EPA directly, because there has not been many opportunities to ask EPA, what does 404 assumption mean in the state of Oregon? And that's basically the conclusion of my testimony.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. You're pulling the mic around. In case you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Regarding the 50 cubic yard exemption, so how does EPA now deal with that exemption?
Well, basically, under federal requirements, we don't have that exemption.
Right, I understand.
So under an assumed program, that would have to go away.
I understand that, but how do you deal with it now when there is not...
We cover it under 404. So the Corps of Engineers basically covers that.
What do you mean covers it?
Basically, when we have an application, and that's the tricky part because many folks consider that they're not covered, they don't need to submit an application. I have to say that probably a lot of our unauthorized activities probably involve, in the federal spectrum, involve the 50 cubic yard situation. So what we've got right now is uncertainty by folks about what's regulated, what's not. Under federal requirements, the 50 cubic yard exemption does not exist. We do have certain exemptions that are covered for agricultural and silvicultural and irrigation practices, but it's on a case-by-case basis.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still somewhat confused. So an applicant needs to go to the state, DSL, and they need to go to the feds. So the state gives them the exemption because there's the 50-yard exemption. Then they go to the state to get the permit, and then what do you do?
Well, it comes to the feds for application, and we're saying we cover that.
I don't know what that means.
Well, what it means is that they may come to the state, and the state may say we have no jurisdiction, but under federal rules, we may say we have jurisdiction. You need to apply for a permit.
I'm still confused. John, look
for the permit. They need a permit from the Corps of Engineers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, you're getting close. If an applicant provides us with a joint application that says that they're doing work of 25 cubic yards, we'll tell them they don't need a state permit. Other than in certain situations. And then when the Corps looks at that same application, they'll say...
You need a permit.
Got it.
Correct.
Thank
and
you.
That's the disconnect that we currently have in the state rules. Great. Because we have folks that think they're exempt in one arena, but they're not exempt in another.
Got it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Chair.
Second time today.
Thank you. Other questions?
I have a question for Ron.
Thank you.
Yvonne, I have a couple of questions. One is, do any other states there's only two that have assumed.
But there are two other states that are pursuing it, which is
okay.
Florida and Kentucky.
So do any of those states have a 50 cubic yard exemption similar to Oregon?
No, they do not.
Okay, so this is fairly
unique. What assumed programs do is they actually blend the best of state and federal requirements into an integrated program. Oregon is unique, and this is probably the most problematic issue as far as 404 assumption is the 50 cubic yard exemption. But understand, too, that while folks perceive that there's a 50 cubic yard exemption afforded under state rules, that exemption does not exist under federal requirements. I just want to say that. Now, how it's actually administered, how it may actually be applied, there's probably some disparity in that regard.
Follow up. Thank you. And would you say, we had a lot of discussion. This is the third session we've had discussions about the 404 assumption, as many of us know. And the question arose last committee meeting about why it's taking so long, and I see that John Lilly has addressed that in his remarks, in his testimony. But would you say that this is typical time frame, what Oregon's going through for assumption, or is it because of the 50 cubic yard?
The 50 cubic yard has been very problematic in the state, but also because they have a great deal of non-assumable waters in the state. Unlike Michigan and New Jersey, they do have a specific coastal zone, but we in this state, we actually have a lot of jurisdictional issues that overlap with the Corps of Engineers on Section 10 under the Rivers and Harbors Act. Our difficulties have been in engaging the Corps of Engineers and defining what the extent of those assumable waters are. We're working on that. It's a collaborative effort. And also recognizing that both in New Jersey and Michigan, they don't actually have a state program general permit. What we've discovered, at least for Oregon, is that if we have a state program general permit, we can actually still continue to provide seamless authorization for projects in non-assumable waters for small categories of activities.
Okay. And a final question is, do you have any type of schedule that you can share with the committee, either Division of State Lands or EPA, that just shows the steps? I mean, what we don't have is a timeline that says, here's the steps that we have to take, here's what we've already achieved, here's what we still have to have, and if there's actual dates that have been assigned to those steps, so we have a better sense of, you know, where we fit in, and if there's deadlines that the state has to meet.
Well, I mean, the good part about SB 172 is that it did require for us, for the state to come back and look at what the assumable package was. If you remove that, then it's kind of like it's back to open-ended question as to what's reviewable and what's not. So what we have as far as timeline is that we know we have dealt with a number of the low-hanging fruit. The higher-hanging fruit of 404 assumption is dealing with defining what is assumable waters, which requires cooperation from the Corps of Engineers. And I don't want to say that, but understand the Corps of Engineers isn't necessarily looking for their folks to be displaced in any way. They're not looking for their regulatory folks to go into maybe in some other arena. But what you're substituting for the Corps of Engineers is actually EPA representation as far as implementing the program. So we still have to find assumable waters. We also have to figure out how we're going to deal with the Endangered Species Act. That is a tricky issue, but we feel as though the state of Oregon actually has some mechanisms in place. It may not be to the satisfaction of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or NOAA Fisheries, but we feel as though we do have some measures in place that we can offer to them as a substitute. That's why the State Program General Permit is actually a very good testing ground for some of those applications. The other low-hanging fruit is basically an issue with regard to state standing. There are some issues, not just in this program, but other issues about citizen lawsuits, about what is their standing if they felt as though they were somehow not represented in the permitting program. What is their standing? And under the Clean Water Act, basically the lawsuit provisions or citizen provisions are pretty broad. In Oregon, they're pretty narrow. And it's really not unique to just 404, but it's actually very analogous to a lot of other delegated programs in the state that we're trying to deal with.
Thank you. Any other questions, committee members? Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Just your last statement about citizen, it sounds like what you're saying, citizen review is not as broad in Oregon as it might be in other states?
Correct. The issue about standing, meaning how you are affected party into a permitting decision for the state of Oregon versus under federal requirements, there's a little bit of disconnect. The state of Oregon actually defines affected parties very narrowly versus the Clean Water Act. The citizen lawsuit provisions are very broad. And so that's one of the issues we're trying to reconcile under an assumed program.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Lilly, do you want to add anything before we call up the next witness?
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, John Lilly, Assistant Director with the Department of State Lands. I only briefly wanted to mention a few things. I provided you kind of a thumbnail sketch of responses to a number of the major issues that were raised in testimony on Monday. I'll not go through that in detail, but I did want to make a few comments. The other thing we have provided you is a copy of the enrolled version of Senate Bill 172, because we've been talking a lot about that over the period of time that we've been discussing this bill, and I thought it would be worthwhile if you had that in your files to peruse. Let me make a couple of comments on the things that were said on Monday. You know, I was listening very carefully to what folks had to say, and I think Ms. Vallette has characterized the issues very well, similar to what I had said the same day or on Monday. But I think that beyond that, you know, what we're talking about in 404 assumption is change. And change is scary, and change is difficult for us to look at sometimes. And as a result, staying with the status quo sometimes looks pretty attractive. I think, though, that when we look at maintaining the status quo, we can't achieve some of the goals that the legislature has set out for us when enacted ORS 196-795, which in a nutshell says that the Department of State Land should pursue methods to streamline the process of administering permits, in particular by reducing paperwork, eliminating duplication, increasing certainty and timeliness, and enhancing resource protection. I think that requires that we, in order to achieve those goals, it requires that we make some changes. And the Department has made a number of changes over the years to streamline its process. We've used a lot more general authorizations. We're more robust in using web-based commenting and notification. And we're open to doing a lot more. One of the things that I heard from the agricultural community representatives was concerns about the kinds of activities that would be regulated under 404 assumption. And so to the paper that I provided for you today is an Exhibit A, where we've attempted to outline the activities that occur on farmland that ranchers, dairymen, nurserymen, and farmers might undertake. And we tried to indicate what types of activities would be exempt and remain exempt under 404 assumption, and what kinds of activities might be covered, in other words, require a permit under an assumed 404 program. I'll not belabor you with all the details there. You can look at that at your leisure. There was a comment about staffing, and would 404 assumption require more staff and therefore more a greater drain on resources that might otherwise go into the common school fund. And without a doubt, we're very concerned about resources being taken from the common school fund. We're all spending a lot of time, or you're all spending a lot of time in this building deliberating over that. And in the past years, the department has not added additional staff to the removal fill program without finding funding other than common school fund funding for them. But if we were to assume, we believe that the current staffing level is adequate, with the exception of the position that we're asking for in the governor's recommended budget, which would be supported by the wetland delineation review fee. In addition, we have a couple of other positions in the budget which would be supported by other funds, not common school funds. But be that as it may, the reason we can say with some confidence that the existing staff level or near to it is adequate is because, as you've heard, largely what we're doing is continuing to do the same work we've always done. We just won't be having the responsibilities of coordinating with the Corps of Engineers and the other agencies besides. So if you think about it carefully, you can see the logic there. If you're doing the same work, you ought to be able to do the same work with the same people, even if you're doing it under an assumed program.
And EPA, under its current wetland programs, basically acknowledged the fact that states that are willing to step up to the plate and do more, we're really willing to provide financial incentive towards that effort, which is why we're actually willing to provide additional resources towards the implementation of the state program general permit.
Then the final comment I would make is on page 3 concerning fines. Existing law that the Department of State Lands is authorized to administer allows the department to assess a civil penalty of up to $10,000 a day. Under Senate Bill 172, EPA required that to have equivalency, we needed to have a criminal penalty of similar amount. But federal penalties are potentially far more severe, as you can see. But under an assumed program, EPA elects, likes the state to take the lead on enforcement. But under a core-administered 404 program, the federal fine structure is outlined, as you can see below, with first convictions running from $2,500 to $25,000 per day and upwards from there. Our track record, our experience in administering civil penalties in the program over the last two fiscal years is we've assessed 22 civil penalties for an average fee of $1,459 in 02-03, and in 03-04, 13 penalties assessed for an average penalty of $7,800.
And probably what's not reflected there is because we know that the state is actually taking the lead on it, we've actually declined on the federal level to administer a separate penalty.
That would conclude my comments. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you again today. Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, so what was the highest penalty assessed in 03-04?
Just give me a moment to look that up. In 03-04, the highest penalty assessed was a total of $23,000.
Thank you. And, John, I keep coming back to the 50 cubic yard exemption. So, John, is there an area that relates to? Is that just one event where somebody is using 50 cubic yards in one event, or say if somebody owns 100,000 acres, would it be total of 50 cubic yards?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I always get these mixed up because it differs whether it's a removal or a fill. Let me refer to the statute, if I may.
The reason I'm asking is that one of the things that was talked about yesterday was events in California, as I recall, the Borden Ranch
case.
Deep ripping. So, I mean, I don't know if this happened over 100 acres or if it happened over 1 acre.
Well,
do you know what I'm asking?
Mr. Chair.
Well, on the federal, because that was actually a federal action, that was actually over multiple acres and it was an ongoing problem. So basically, it was treated as of the higher level of our administrative penalties as far as dealing with that issue, because it was one where there were multiple notices provided to the landowner about potential violations, but those notices were ignored.
Okay.
And it was constitute basically as a high resource value wetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, to your original question. The definition of fill in the state of Oregon is the total of deposits by artificial means equal to or exceeding 50 cubic yards or more of material at one location in any waters of the state. So it's 50 cubic yards one time for fill.
One location, like?
Yes.
Okay.
There could be multiple locations on a single property, but you only get 50 yards one time.
On all those multiple locations?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And then on removal, removal is the taking of more than 50 cubic yards from waters of the state in any calendar year. So in theory, a person could go and remove, let's say gravel. Someone could remove 49 yards of gravel from their riverfront property in 1 year and then come back another calendar year and take the 49 yards again.
Follow up.
That's current state
follow up.
So if this river meandered through the property for 25 miles totally, they could only remove 50 cubic yards. Is that right?
Yes, not more than 50 cubic yards is correct.
In that whole many acres?
Per year.
Thank you.
One clarification I would add, that there is a designation called essential salmon habitat. And where those, that is waters of streams in Oregon, there are about 25,000 miles of them, where there are spawning and rearing habitat for threatened state and federal listed species. The state of Oregon law on those waters is that we have a zero cubic yard tolerance on those waters. But the majority of the waters in the state and wetlands, there is this 50 cubic yard limitation.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have some questions. You make a point that there are two states, Yvonne, that have
assumed the program,
and a couple of others that are contemplating. If we were to assume those two others that are contemplating were to enact the enabling legislation and get everything, whatever it was, done, there'd be four states that have taken on the assumption.
Correct.
I would, I suppose, note with that that there are 46 states then that have not.
Yeah. We recognize that 4-4 assumption is actually a very high hurdle for many states. And while EPA provides financial assistance to states to work towards that, we recognize it's a very high hurdle. Most states actually only rely on their water quality certifications as their main measure to protect aquatic resources in their states.
And if you let me continue here, I point out that the state of Oregon has already demonstrated their willingness to step up to this. The problem that this legislator has with what has taken place is we've been 4 years, and from everything I can tell, no closer to a memorandum of understanding than we were when Senate Bill 172 passed way back in the dark ages 4 years ago. And as a consequence, I think this is more than sufficient to demonstrate for us that there's somehow or another, and I'm not saying who's right, who's wrong, or who's on second with this. But by the time, if this process continues, by the time we get to an assumption passing, it is likely that the statute that we currently have in existence is going to be archaic and obsolete and need to be replaced again. So let me tell you what I plan to do with this bill. I plan to pass this bill out with a July 1, 2007 implementation date, which will give us 2 years for the department to work on this issue. And if we're successful in working on it, the legislature in 2007 will be able to take the appropriate action to move it on. So it is my plan then to hold this over until Friday, and I apologize for being out of the room, but obviously I was out of the room talking to council. My plan to hold it over till Friday when we have the amendment, and then it would be my plan to move it at that particular point with an implementation date of July 1, 2007, which will be after the next, whatever, 74th Legislative Assembly has had an opportunity to meet. Because I would like to point out that state of Oregon is, and I think has already demonstrated, has, and I think we've demonstrated that, a willingness to work hard on these issues, even though 46 other states haven't gotten there. Because it is complicated, because there are a lot of things going on, you know, with it, and because a lot of us don't know an awful lot about, you know, either fill and removal or 404, at any rate, that would be my plan to proceed along that line, which is a change, appreciate, in my plans when we came into the committee today was to move the bill forward today. But you have proceeded to persuade me of some merit in giving you a little more time to work on this and giving DSL in the state. I'm not picking, saying EPA is at fault here or that the Corps of Engineers are at fault, or I'm not saying, it doesn't really matter. I'm hoping for it to be a 2-year extension, and I'm looking forward to that time.
And basically, the way we proceed, basically, for assumption, it's a brass ring. Basically, if the state can basically meet those requirements, it's theirs for the taking. And that's all EPA is there to do, is to provide them basically with the counsel in how to achieve that level of assurance. And what we look for, because we have actually spent a great deal of resources in working with the state on these issues, we've dealt with some of the low-hanging fruit. We have still some of the more difficult issues to deal with. We're just looking for a commitment that's worthy of our continued commitment working with the state on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we can work with your with the wording on your amendment. We look forward to seeing it on Friday.
Are there any questions from the committee after? We're in a public hearing at this point. Let me close that public hearing and open a work session so you're at freedom to appropriately talk about the issue as we've described it. If there's any discussion on that. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that looking at Mr. Lilly's memorandum on the second page at the top, this is the problem that EPA is as non-negotiable on allowing the 50 cubic yard exemption as the agricultural community is on allowing it to be repealed. So it seems to me like that is the real sticking point, isn't it? Am I understanding that correctly?
I think you're correct, Representative, that is an area of great concern.
I think I was probably on the Water Committee when that bill was passed and 4 years ago in 2005. Can you help me remember how that happened to be passed to allow the 50 cubic yard exemption?
I don't think that goes back to the dark ages. That's not part of it.
Okay.
But the reality is whatever the state exemption is, there's still basically, those are activities that are still covered under federal jurisdiction.
I realize that.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying is
right.
It seems like how did that ever happen? Excuse me.
Yeah.
How did that happen before your time also?
The time of Moses, if I'm not I don't know. We'd have to do a search of the to find out when that was, and maybe
Mr. Lilly could do that for us.
Mr. Lilly's been around since Moses.
I don't know whether he's as old as Moses or not, but.
I believe that the provisions on the 50-yard exemption, if you will, were in the original legislation that began and was first passed in 1967. We've been living with it for some time. Some of the earlier discussions about 404 assumption, there was a change made in the statute that would waive that exemption if the state were to ever assume 404. And then when Senate Bill 172 was passed, of course, you have that in front of you. And the only time there was an amendment to change that exemption under state law was dealing with the essential salmon habitat program, as I explained earlier in my testimony.
Okay.
So that was, that was a fairly recent exemption.
Yeah, that exemption, or that the lifting of the 50-yard exemption for essential salmon habitat occurred in the 93 session, I believe.
Okay. Thank you.
And while I have been around a long time, I haven't been around as long as 1967.
Okay. I still have Chris Bayham to testify. If you would, please. Good afternoon, Chris.
Good morning, everybody. Good afternoon. Excuse me. I'm coming back from Enterprise, so I'm a little jet lagged. I was just going to indicate that the Association of Oregon Counties, and I don't think I'm going to be telling you anything that you don't already know.
Except maybe your name.
Oh, Chris Bayham, Association of Oregon Counties, County Road Program. AOC is opposed to 2915, and our opposition stems from our desire to see House Bill 2082 or something in effect that would allow the state to assume Section 404 from EPA. I think county road programs and counties in general would like to see that happen. That would greatly streamline permitting for county road departments. And if you were to take a look at all the environmental requirements that are expected of a transportation system, you'd appreciate the need for an effort to streamline, consolidate the state and federal requirements. And an assumption of 404 of the Clean Water Act does that. And the best example I can give you for the need for something to that effect, to have the state assume Section 404, would be the meeting we had yesterday with DEQ to discuss some problems that occurred in the processing of a state removal fill permit, which was done in conjunction with a Section 404 permit under the joint permitting process that's currently in place. We had one permit go through with an approval, and that was the Army Corps of Engineer permit, and it had a set of conditions that were somewhat different than, say, the state removal fill permit. And the state removal fill permit was hung up, and that resulted in delays for the county in getting its road work done that it had planned to do for this summer. And that those delays cost time for not only the consultant that the county was using, and that cost, you know, additional money for the county to pay that consultant. And it just caused a lot of time on everybody's part, including mine, to resolve the differences between the dual permitting process. You have one permit that's approved, another that's not for some reason. It just creates a lot of frustration, and it generates a lot of effort on everybody's part. And to see some sort of consolidation would be desirable from the County Road Department's perspective. And that's really all I have to say. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Chris. In light of the fact, as we found out this afternoon, that there are 48 other states that don't have this one-stop shopping on this, you must have a lot of company in a lot of other counties across the United States. So it should give counties something to talk about when they get together in various and sundry meetings, various and sundry places. So I appreciate your points. I appreciate the points of others who have come forth and spoken in favor of this bill. So far, again, as we've said, we haven't got any place, and if we're going to go any someplace, we need to do so or else get the bill off the statutes and start over again with something. So,
would that be referred to as fish or cut bait, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, I suppose. It could be. I don't think so. Any other things? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before I don't have any questions for Chris, but before you close the work session, I'm just curious with regards to the idea of putting a effective date of this bill in place. Never mind. I just figured it out. Never mind.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. With this, we will close the work session on House Bill 2915, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2265. And Representative Trumbull.
Mr. Chair, I would move. Dash threes we need to put in on this one? They're already in there. Yeah. Dash threes.
As amended.
On 427. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Help me out here, Sandy.
That's okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you recall, the committee adopted the Dash 3 amendments, which are dated April 26, 2005, on April 27. So those amendments have been moved into the bill. And that is where we're at this particular point. So.
Representative Crumb.
Dash 4, I do, don't I? No.
Two ways and means.
Two ways and means. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2265 to the floor, or excuse me, as amended, to the Committee on Ways and Means. With it.
No recommendation.
No recommendation.
Very good. Thank you, Representative. Representative Crumbull moves House Bill 2265 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with no recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just to be certain.
Yes, sir.
As amended means the dash threes.
Dash threes. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
We've added the dash threes already, too.
Yes, yes. I recall. Thank you, sir. Yeah. I don't have any. That was just a question. That's all I have.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's fine. No other questions? We'll call the roll, please.
I was about to speak. I like the original bill, and it seemed to me if I'm remembering correctly, although I'm not seeing my notes to that effect, but we had testimony from quite a few people who said that they would welcome a fee increase. Am I thinking of the same bill, Mr. Chair? Am I not?
I assume there must be somebody that wants a fee increase, no one other than the department.
Just not Mike Shoffler.
Right? Just not
Mr.
Just not Mr.
He doesn't Shoffler. Want.
He doesn't want a bill.
Well, I can't find my notes, and maybe it was a different bill, so I will not see anything further.
My options today there were two options that I had today.
Okay.
One was to move the Dash 4 amendment and then pass it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The other was to move move it as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. And it has to go to Ways and Means because there is a prior referral.
Mr. Chair, just clarification. I think, Representative Tomei, this bill does include a fee increase. It is, with the dash threes, that's that 44-page amendment that you have, that's the increase that DSL is requesting. And just for clarification, is that with or without the wetland mitigation fee in the dash?
So
it's with both a fee increase and a new fee for the wetland mitigation. Is that correct?
That's correct. Sandy?
Okay. So this is just an amended version of that original bill. Yeah, it was 2130.
Yes.
That was
2130 was the first bill that you had on this, and we moved 2130 to. This is the gut and stuff. We gutted 2265 and moved 2130 to 2265.
Okay.
And that's the reason you're seeing amendments and things there. So that's basically the original House Bill 2130 is what you have, plus we added to House Bill 20 to that another amendment, which was a technical fix to House Bill or to Senate Bill 82 from the 03 legislative session.
Who's on first, Mr. Chair?
Messerly.
What's on second?
So at this point, we're not moving the dash force.
At this point, we're not moving the dash force.
Got it.
It's going to Ways and Means with the dash three. Assuming you vote for it. If you vote against it, fine, then we'll go back and add the dash four.
And again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash threes, the committee has already voted on, and at that point, and I apologize, I don't have the attendance here, but there were no objections in the adoption of the dash threes. So I feel comfortable in saying that on April 27th, we had a full committee in attendance. So at that point, that motion.
And this is what we're voting on, the dash three.
Oh, yes, yes, sir.
Senate to wait 21.
No, no, no.
We've already adopted those.
Those have already been adopted. You are moving on moving the bill. No, no, no. The bill with the dash threes without recommendation to Ways and Means.
That's what we're moving.
That's right. Correct.
Okay.
Got it.
Page 40.
Page 40.
Is the where this dash fours began.
Okay. Section 21 on is the dash three amendment.
Four.
That's four. I don't know. It just seemed like an important thing to talk about.
Call roll, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Dalto?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Representative Colonel?
Aye.
Representative
Terry Jensen? Aye. House Bill 2265. As amended, has been moved to the Committee on Ways and Means with no recommendation. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2265. And I see we have the... we'll open a public hearing on SJM 7.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Joint Memorial 7 is petitioning Congress of the United States to preserve the federal funding at its current levels for the maintenance and navigation channels of the ports and to fully expend all monies collected in the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund. The memorial moved off of the Senate floor with 26 ayes, no votes, 2 absence excused, and 2 legislative business. There is no fiscal or revenue impact on this memorial.
Okay. We have Mr. Armstrong, and you're the only one left to testify on this?
Apparently I am, Mr. Chair. My compatriots have abandoned me. I'm Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Ports Group. Signed up with me today were Peter Williamson, the president of the Oregon Ports Group and also the general manager of the Port of St. Helens, and Pat Egan with the Port of Portland. And Mr. Egan may be coming in as I speak, but if not, I'm going to be it for you. The purpose of Senate Joint Memorial 7 was really the brainchild of the Senate Transportation Committee. As we were before that committee talking about other issues, the question of continued federal funding for dredging came up, and it was the opinion of the chair, and we conveniently agree strongly with her, that it would be a good statement from this legislative body to communicate to the federal government, to the United States Congress, that continued federal funding of navigation dredging is a critical function and something that the federal government needs to a role they continue to need to play. State of Oregon continues to appropriate money for dredging projects, and we need to make sure that the federal government hears from the state of Oregon that that is a critical element of keeping Oregon vital as a trading partner on the Pacific Rim. And that's the brief history of Senate Joint Memorial 7. There was no testimony against, as you heard from staff, no opponents on the floor, and we encourage this committee to move forward with SJM 7.
Questions? Mr. Armstrong.
I have a question.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Thank you. And I'm just not familiar with the funding source for the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund. Is that It's an appropriation.
It is a tax on imports, and that is something that is has been building up over the years. There is a carry forward balance every year, and I really couldn't tell you how much that is. But it is one of the things that the memorial suggests is those dollars need to be expended. And when we have administrations suggesting, as they do year after year, that appropriations be eliminated or reduced for several of the ports around the nation, and specifically in Oregon, some of the shallow draft ports, those are dollars that need to get expended here in Oregon and elsewhere.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
So these funds are already collected. They're sitting in a fund somewhere, and they're not being basically allocated by Congress. Are they going somewhere else, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, they are sitting there, but they are not, and they continue to accrue,
mm-hmm.
But they are not being expended in their entirety. A portion of it gets expended to cover dredging around the country, but there is a fairly substantial, I hesitate to guess, but I'm thinking it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 million, something like that, that is sitting there and that has not been expended. I will double-check on that and find out if that's correct, make sure I gave you the right information. But the money does get expended partially, but it continues to have a carry-forward balance.
Mr. Chair?
I just had one final question. Is there any type of state match? In other words, do ports have to provide a certain percentage locally in order to qualify for that federal funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, yes. On new construction dredging, that is correct. On maintenance dredging, no. Federal government pays for that in its entirety. But new construction, such as the Columbia River Channel Deepening Project, there is a state match on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
Just more or less a comment. I think that this not expending the funds that are in these trust funds are an act of trying to balance the budget. This not only happens with these dredging funds, but with other trust funds that are back there. The Northwest is somewhat unique, and Oregon particularly unique, in our harbors as opposed to the rest of the nation, in that we have to have this dredging or our shipping will not go in and out of these harbors because they sailed in so badly and the bar conditions are so much different than, say, up at Puget Sound where they need very little dredging. And also on the East Coast where most of their harbors are don't require this type of maintenance dredging. So for us to stay in the shipping business, it's absolutely essential that we have this. That's not only important for the shipping industry, but for the safety of any traffic in and out of those harbors on the Oregon coast.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Brown said it. Our small harbors have got to be cleaned out periodically. And I think, in addition to the comments he made, it's also important for tourism and fisheries. So I don't have any problem with this proposal. Makes sense.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carmel.
Is some of the money that is in this the dollars that are earmarked for dredging by the feds of the Columbia River? On the 114 miles from Astoria to Portland?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, yes, that's correct.
So we definitely want to understand that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Armstrong, we appreciate your testimony, and colleagues, we're not going to do a work session on the bill. I guess we can't because it's, we could, but I'm not going to do a work session today. We will put that on a work session for the first next week on Monday and plan to move it out at that point unless we have some conflicting things come in between now and then. Then with this, we're going to close the public hearing on SJM 7 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 848.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 848 comes over to the House chamber as an A and Gross. It authorizes county service districts operating that operate service facilities for the purpose of providing water resource management services in Washington County to acquire conservation easements. The bill has no fiscal or revenue impact. It left the Senate chamber with 25 ayes, 4 excused, and 1 excused legislative business. So there was no opposition on the floor. And as it left the committee, the Senate Committee on Environment and Land Use, there was no opposition at that point either. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sandy. I have Senator Kubiak.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be before you this afternoon. I'm Gerald Kubiak. I'm representing Washington County and also Clean Water Services. They're a sister agency, a county service district organized under ORS Chapter 451 that provides water management services to urban Washington County. And I'm joined by Mark Jockers to my right, the public affairs manager for Clean Water Services. We'll be brief this afternoon. This is a fairly straightforward bill. Again, we appreciate the opportunity to get a few minutes of your time. The issue that we face that's prompted us to ask for this bill's introduction is a case where, per statute, there's a limited grouping of agency types that can grant conservation easements. Cities and counties are among them. County service districts are not among them. And this bill is, we believe, more about efficiency and less about the policy discussions around what types of entities should be able to grant conservation easements. That's an interesting area, and it's one that we're happy to be involved in a discussion on. But the issue that we've got that we want to address through this bill is, as a county, our county Board of Commissioners is able to work through staff and obtain conservation easements. That same governing body, when it convenes as the Board of Directors for the Clean Water Services Agency, cannot work to obtain conservation easements. And so what we've got is a situation where this, where the sister agency, Clean Water Services, is basically required to work through the county through an intergovernmental agreement to have the county obtain the conservation easement for it on its behalf. And we believe it poses unnecessary administrative demands and really just is not a good use of resources. Sort of the underlying logic behind the bill is that you've got one governing body, two agencies. The governing body, when it wears its county hat, does already have conservation easement authority. When it wears its county service district hat, it does not have that authority. So the bill's narrowly drafted. It pertains only to those county service districts that have the board of their board of directors is the Board of County Commissioners, and they provide certain functions, sanitary sewer service and surface water management services. So it's a narrow range of agencies, and we believe there's a strong rationale there for efficiency that makes this a good bill, and we appreciate your interest in it and would request your support. I'd be happy to answer questions, and if not, I'll turn it over to Mr. Jockers.
Maybe Mr. Jockers could speak, and if we have questions, we can go that route.
Thank you, Chief Jensen. My name is Mark Jockers, and I'm the Public Affairs Manager with Clean Water Services. As Gerald said, Clean Water Services is a county special service district that was established in 1970 under ORS 451 to provide sanitary sewer services to urban Washington County, and we also assumed responsibility for surface water management in 1990. Today, we work in partnership with 12 member cities in urban Washington County to coordinate not only sanitary sewer and surface water management, but also long-term water supply planning. We manage flow in the Tualatin River itself and work to protect public health and the environment for about 500,000 customers in our service district. While the Washington County Commission serves as our board, we are, as Gerald said, a separately managed and financed public utility. In the last decade, Clean Water Services has pursued a very aggressive strategy to provide our customers with the best service possible and most efficiently. And we've examined everything we've done to figure out how to do this more efficiently and meet our customers' needs and to advance the health of the Tualatin River watershed. At the same time, we've had to deal with, in the last decade, 110,000 new customers that have moved into our service district. Thanks to the leadership of our board of directors, in the last 10 years, the district's efficiency efforts, despite the growth in our customer base, we've been able to reduce our staff by 22%, consolidated our facilities from 8 to 6, and renegotiated all of our contracts with chemical and energy costs to try to provide the best value for our customers. Despite the growing capital and capacity needs we have in Washington County, our sanitary sewer rates right now are actually lower in constant dollars than they were 10 years ago, and our surface water management fee has been raised just once in the last 15 years. Now, this speaks directly to Senate Bill 848, because Senate Bill 848 will help us streamline the easement process for property owners as we work with them, and therefore streamline the process for Clean Water Services staff also. We want to seek efficiencies through this bill today. It will help us meet those efficiency goals by, one, as I said, streamlining the process for property owners and ourselves, and two, for protecting the public's investment in stream corridor restorations. In the last 5 years, Clean Water Services has invested a little over $5 million in stream restoration projects, and our capital budget in the next 5 years looks at more than doubling that. The Conservation Easement Authority that's in the bill that you're looking at today will help us protect the public investment, provide additional flexibility to landowners and ourselves, and reduce a somewhat cumbersome, complex, and frankly inefficient process to the simple voluntary property transaction that it should be. Voluntary conservation easements can also help Clean Water Services build the partnerships that are critical to advancing the health of the Tualatin River watershed. Those are the only comments I had. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you. My only question is this: I really have two counties in my district, and I believe that Clackamas County also has a similar service district. I think it's Clackamas Special District 1. That also provides the same types of services. Would this bill, the way it's written, pertain to Clackamas Service District?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, no, it does not. We, in developing the concept behind this bill, we noted that we believe we have an unusual or a fairly uncommon situation, but not an entirely unique situation. And in preparing materials and so forth in our efforts on this bill, we've confirmed that there are 50-some county service districts in the state, and of that population of agencies, there are only a handful that provide services similar to those of Clean Water Services and those that Representative Crummell mentions in Clackamas County. And I believe it's one agency, and it may be another county service district or two in Clackamas County that provide similar services. Also, per statute, their boards of directors is the Board of Commissioners for Clackamas County. And so we believe, you know, the logic that applies to our situation applies similarly to those agencies in Clackamas County, and we would certainly be supportive and interested in working with them to somewhat broaden the language in this bill so it applies to the Clackamas County agencies.
So if we wanted to... I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, may I? Thank you. So if we wanted to amend the bill to either apply to Clackamas County or to other such districts around the state, there wouldn't be a problem with that? You'd be amenable to that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, not a problem at all, and we'd be happy to work with the appropriate folks to get that done.
May I follow up, Mr.
Follow up.
Do you know, besides Clackamas County, are there any other counties that have a similar situation?
Representative Crummell, Chair Jensen, there are 52 county service districts in the state of Oregon, according to the Secretary of State's office. The answer to that is no. The only ones that have both sanitary sewer and surface water management functions would be Clean Water Services, Clackamas County, Service District Number 1, and there are two other service districts in Clackamas County that are similar, but one only provides sewer and one only provides surface water management, but they are similar in terms of water. Many of the other county service districts in the state include things like ambulance districts, law enforcement districts, things like that.
Right, okay. Mr. Chair, I would ask if, since they are Washington County folks, would be amenable to this. I just would ask if we could have either staff request an amendment to include the Clackamas County side to this. I don't know if you're amenable to that. Also, I guess that's kind of important.
Yeah.
Minor detail here, right?
Representative, certainly staff can, or you can. I mean, either way, we'd be happy to look at and talk about the amendment. Obviously, time is not as much of an essence on this as it is on House bills, either,
right?
Because we're closing down. So that, yes, that's possible. And we would certainly do that, but I'm not sure we can get Representative Dinkfelder nor Representative Tomei on board with this, because if I understand the bill correctly, this is going to get into taking some county tax money away, and that'll be money coming basically out of schools, as well as some other areas, and I'm not sure how much support we'll get from that.
Mr. Chair, question I had is whether or not we should consult with Clackamas County, and I was going to ask,
yes,
Mark, if you have discussed this with Clackamas County.
Yes, we have.
And are they amenable?
Yes.
Somebody behind you shaking their head.
Yes.
I don't know what it is.
That's B.J. Smith, and she's a lobbyist for Clackamas County.
There you
County.
Go. So I don't know if you want to ask Clackamas County to...
Could we bring her up to testify, Mr. Chair?
But of course. Please. So Clackamas County have an interest in taking more money away from our children.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am B.J. Smith. I'm the Government Relations Director for Clackamas County. I think it is important to understand that those easements are currently being granted in the name of the county. What this really does is it just makes certain that the easements can, or that the conservation easements can be granted in the name of the service district. Ours is the we have a large service district that functions very comparably to Washington County, and we would be happy to be a part of this. The only reason we did not bring this up in the Senate was because of the progression of the bill. And so we have been talking about that for some time.
Representative, I would ask you, along as well as working with BJ, to get us before we... I'd be happy to have the amendments brought forward, but before we go anywhere with it, to ensure that we're not crossways with Clackamas County Commissioners or anyone else, whoever is in authority on this thing. I don't want to get crossways with local government when this isn't what they want to do, and I'm sure you would appreciate that as much more than I do.
I do have an appreciation for that, and working with DJ and also with the Clackamas County Commission Chair, Martha Schrader, I'll be glad to effectuate that and make sure that we what we do is will
yeah,
be inclusive
in keeping where they're.
Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 848, and we will reopen our hearing on SJM 7. And Mr. Egan has found time to come back.
Special attention. You never know if that's a good thing or not. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pat Egan, for the record, Pat Egan representing the Port of Portland, and thank you for the opportunity to thank you for considering SJM 7. I was out of the room dealing with trains, and so now I'm going to tell you a little bit about ships and automobiles. We are the number one grain port in the United States and the number one auto port on the West Coast. SJM 7, the chair will remember, at various points I've shared my own personal opinion of memorials to Congress, and in this particular case I actually think this is a worthwhile one to send. Congress considers the use of harbor maintenance tax fees basically as general fund, and are used. These are used for numerous purposes. Our delegation, not just Oregon's delegation, but the Northwest delegation, including the senators and members of Congress, are all very supportive of marine commerce. And this is, I think, a letter of support to them, effectively, for their support of marine commerce. As I think Ken Armstrong told you earlier, and I think he indicated to me what he told you, these harbor maintenance tax fees are basically bled off into other programs. We would like to see them go into not just navigation channels, but harbor and docks and those kinds of improvements that are very important to the jobs that we provide both on docks and the shipping services that we provide throughout the region. So really just wanted to say thank you very much for this, and just a couple of quick facts and figures to add to lines 20 to 29 of the bill. We have done numerous studies on what we save shippers, and we believe we save shippers just in the container business alone in the order of $68 million a year just by having the Port of Portland. If the Port of Portland did not have a container terminal, shippers in Oregon would have to get their goods up through Tacoma, down to Oakland or some other port, and we believe that we save them significant costs by having the marine terminal. And thank you again for your support. Happy to take any questions.
Questions for Mr. Egan.
I'm just astounded, Mr. Chair, that we're the number one port on the West Coast for automobiles. What's the name of that port on the north side of Los Angeles?
LA, maybe it's maybe Long Beach that you're referring to.
There's another one. I can't think of the name, but...
Mr. Chair, Representative D'Alto, actually it was astounding to me when I first came to the port, but it's an absolute fact, and I'd be happy. What's that?
Mr. Chair, Oxnard, California.
Yeah, they do bring in a lot of vehicles. We bring in a lot more. Toyota just re-signed a 15-year lease with us. We have extensions with Hyundai, Honda. We do bring in some vehicles for some of the other domestic domestic producers that actually import some of their vehicles. We actually export a lot of auto parts in containers to offshore facilities, and it's a big part of our business, and so we're very proud of that, and I'd be happy to get you and the other committee members data on that. Thank you very much.
It's the largest inland grain port.
Yep.
Correct.
In the United States.
Yes, sir.
In the world?
I'm not 100% sure of the world, but I will be happy to get you figures on that as well.
I think so.
Thank you.
More reasons to dredge.
More reason.
That's right.
And actually, Mr. Chair, if you would like, I don't know if Ken gave you an update on that, just very briefly. We let the contracts on that a couple of weeks ago, had to re-let them because the contract was a little bit too large, but we are about to sign a contract to do about 26 of the river miles this calendar year. And so happy that that's finally going forward.
Great. Glad to
Thank
hear
you.
That. With that, we'll close the public hearing on SJM 7. And I am going to, at this particular point, close the committee for today.
Sure.